Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
I'm Jacqueline. I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the newcomers, and congratulations on your 90 days. That's awesome. To those of you that are new, this program works miracles, and I feel like sometimes that word can get thrown around a lot in these rooms, but for me, this program has been miraculous. I came into the rooms on October 17th of 2005 and have stayed sober since. I just celebrated 10 years. October of 2005 was not the first time that I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in 2002 because my drinking and using was not serving me anymore, and I had a lot of consequences as the result of my use. But I came into the rooms in 2002 for all the wrong reasons, and I just wanted to find a way to be able to, like, drink and use successfully without consequence. And I wasn't willing to go to a single length then, let alone any length, you know? And I didn't stay sober. I had a couple periods of time where I was dry, but I never had a program until I came into the rooms in 2005. And for me, my drinking and using took me to a lot of, like, really dark and insane places. When I was asked to be the speaker at this meeting, I was taught by my sponsor that I don't turn down AA requests, so I said yes. And a lot of times I do AA obligations for that purpose. And I was okay with it even when I heard that there were, like, you know, a couple hundred people. I thought, okay, I can do it. Like, God will be with me. And then I read the sort of, like, two-page outline of what this meeting entailed that Joe had sent my way, and I saw that it was going to be recorded. And I thought, holy shit, I don't want, like, you know, like, an ongoing record of, like, me and the nightmare that was, like, of my drinking, because I feel like in a lot of ways, like, what I share at meetings when I'm the main speaker is some of the worst parts of my disease. You know, it's like that whole what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I just recently completed a doctorate in clinical psychology. I'm getting ready to, like, go into the field. I'm, like, you know, minutes away from being licensed. And my fear was, like, oh my God, what if the CD gets, like, disseminates, and then, like, people that I'm going to be seeing hear this? You know, there's supposed to be, like, some anonymity. And then I just thought, I called a friend and was like, I shouldn't do this. This isn't, like, the right thing. And my friend said, you know, you got to look at what your true fear is. Like, where is this really stemming from? And I guess all of this is to say that I trust in a power greater than myself, that I'm here. If I'm here doing my primary purpose, which is to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to other people, that God's going to take care of me, and whatever career endeavors or aspirations are meant to be, God's going to allow that. Not to mention, if you do a Google search of my name, the first thing that comes up is that I escaped a psychiatric facility while in police custody. So, it's like, I'm really not all that anonymous anyways. And I called this woman from the Santa Maria Times about a year ago because I did a Google search, and I was like, holy shit, that's the first thing that comes up. Like, how am I ever going to, like, make anything of myself? And I talked to the editor, and I was like, you know, is there any way that maybe you could remove this? And she's like, well, why would we do such a thing? And I said, well, I'm like, that was over 10 years ago. I'm trying to do esteemable things. I'd like to have some kind of a professional future, and this is no longer the life I'm leading. And she was like, well, it was public news then, and it's public news now. And I said, okay, thank you, and hung up the phone. That's not what I thought. But today, Alcoholics Anonymous has helped me to act better than I think. And I think that's, like, kind of going forward, what enabled me to come here and do this today, despite a lot of fear. So for me, what it was like, I grew up in an alcoholic household. My father was a very active, violent, rageful alcoholic. And I made a pact with myself early on that I didn't want to be like that. I saw what it did to my family. And so at, like, maybe 7 or 8 years old, I swore off forever with and without a solemn oath that I never wanted to drink. I never wanted to use drugs. I didn't want to be like my father. And I held true to that pact until a couple months before my 18th birthday. And I gave way. The first time I drank, I was a blackout drinker. I had 3 beers, 2 Jack and Cokes, half a fifth of Bacardi Limon, a cigarette, and it was, like, on. And I remember vividly that night I was offered like all the promises that it talks about in the big book. Like I found this serenity, this peace, like I no longer feared people and like, you know, I just felt a sense of ease. And it wasn't until maybe about a year ago when I was reading some of the stories in the back of the big book that for the first time in the big book, like something really, really grasped me. I think everything I can relate to it. But you know that 552, like if you resent somebody, pray for them for 2 weeks. My sponsor was like, hey, you've been sitting on this one for a while. Why don't you read the whole story? And I read that whole story and I felt like, oh my God, that is me. And one of the opening lines is like, way before I picked up that first drink, I saw that I was like emotionally ill. And that's how it was for me. I think I needed a drink at like 3, 4, 5, 6 years old. Like I was mentally insane. I had a mind that would not shut off. And it was like this constant state of like fear. What is going to happen? I'm not going to be okay. Total annihilation of self. It is not going to be okay. And up until 17, I found some like healthy outlets to do obsessively. Predominantly like school for a while. I remember like I got straight A's my, fifth grade year. And then it was like, oh my God, I have to get straight A's. And I used to like pray like, dear God, if you're out there, let me get an A on this exam. Because if I don't get an A on this exam, then I'm nothing, you know, like just this insanity. And so I put that insanity to good use for a period of time. And then I had that first drink and that sense of ease and comfort came over me. And I threw up all over my dress that night. It was winter formal. I had to hide it. I woke up the next morning not remembering a whole lot, but I knew that I had found like salvation and I couldn't wait to do it again. And that's how I started out drinking and that's how it was till the end. I didn't like have like sips of beer periodically enjoying it, leisurely maintaining a buzz. Like I liked it to be all on like fucking Donkey Kong as quick as possible. And I started to have some consequences as the result of my use very early on. If there was something that was put in the way of me and attaining whatever it was that I wanted, I found a way around the system. So I started making fake IDs when I was in high school so that I could get access to alcohol. And doing these kind of things to get access to things that, like, you know, the fraternal order of law doesn't want me to have access to, there's consequences. I was not a very smart criminal. And I remember at 19, I was, at this party, there were lights shining on us. I started cussing at people. It was the cops, you know, they detained me in their car. And like, I'm a nonconformist to this day. And when somebody tells me to do something that I don't want to do, it's a challenge. And when I'm under the influence, I have no censorship whatsoever. So I become like one of those crazy chicks and cops where I'm like beating my head against the window. They're like begging me like, please, we don't want to take you into like full on custody. Just cooperate with us. And I'm calling them every name in the book, telling them how good their mother is and this, that, and the other. And everybody around me just would kind of say like, Jack, stop, just stop, like have a little bit of a kill switch, but I didn't have a kill switch. And so what happened is I was no longer able to successfully use around other people. I had this delusion that I was the life of the party. I never was the life of the party. I was the disaster of the party from day number one. And I realized, so I was an alcoholic, like drank alcoholically from the beginning, but what happened is, when people drink, like, it's more of a social substance. Like, I'm out in the world drinking, and so then I would get in trouble, and I would have these consequences, and I would have, like, you know, dudes that were 6'4" clocking me in the face, giving me 2 black eyes, and I didn't play well with others. So I started getting into other substances, and I stopped drinking because I was like, wow, I really have a problem with alcohol. So I stopped that, and then I would switch to, like, other things, and more about alcoholism, that first part of chapter 3 is my favorite part of the big book. I feel like that so succinctly describes my story and what so many of us try to do. It's like that illusion that somehow, some way, maybe I can control and enjoy my drinking. And if I can't control and enjoy my drinking, then I'm going to control and enjoy like pounding Robitussin or smoking salvia or like snorting lines of Adderall or, you know, Xanax and Valium and, you know, somas, like all this stuff. It was just to change the way that I felt. And I know that this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but for me, what happened is I couldn't use alcohol successfully, so I turned to other things. And I would say it was in, so 2002, I had my first like major run-in with the law. I was at a Charger 49er game, really, really long story. I ended up cutting my arm open on this arm right here, like some of the like main veins right here, and I said to the cops, like, I just want to die, I don't care, my life doesn't matter. And little did I know that that would be like my first golden ticket to a 5150 involuntary psych hold. So I went through all that, and I remember at the time, like, my family, they were trying to figure out, like, is she an alcoholic and an addict? Is she mentally ill? Like, what do we treat first? Where is it? And there was just, like, all this confusion, and I had no idea. It was just like, hey, this thing that was my best friend has now turned on me, and I'm no longer getting, like, much of an escape anymore. The, like, little bit of, like, freedom and liberty that I have when I'm under the influence is quickly annihilated by the consequences, because I would just get into so much trouble. And in the like sort of lows, I made it out of that like involuntary hold. I went back up to school. By the grace of something greater than me, I managed to graduate with my bachelor's amidst like all this chaos. I had to take a year off of school, total in undergrad, because I was in and out of jails and institutions, but would have like brief intervals where I would like have like flight into health. I would get a little bit of time dry, pull my shit together, do like 5 or 6 classes at a time, max out, you know, pass the classes, and then it would like all fall apart again. And in 2002, I got to this place where I was like, I can no longer use successfully. I'm a head case. I'm going in and out of like jails and institutions. My family can't really deal with me anymore. I don't want to burden them. And I felt like that loneliness that they talk about in the Big Book that only alcoholics know. So for me, my solution was I should just end it all. And it wasn't a cry for help. It was just truly like I could not figure out how to live successfully. My attempts to live successfully with substances had failed. So I thought, I'll just end it all and that will be it. But I didn't want my family to have the pain that like they had somehow failed me. So I had this bright idea that I would go to the UC Santa Barbara bookstore, steal stuff that said like hats, keychains, beanies, sweatshirts, coffee mugs that say somebody from UCSB loves me. I was going to mail it out to them for Christmas, commit suicide, and then they could just have that knowing that, you know, it wasn't them, it was me. I ended up getting arrested at the UC Santa Barbara bookstore, which is like, I mean, talk about like God intervening, you know? And I wasn't happy about it then, but like, I truly believe that I would have gone through with that plan had it not been for that. And so then I was in police custody, and I was a nightmare. I was floridly psychotic. I thought I was the female version of Eminem. I was convinced that it was just a matter of time before I would come up with like, you know, all my songs, release my LP. I didn't understand why I was like in the custody of police. I just wanted to like be left alone. And what happened through all that, like, I ended up having some pretty serious charges. A little bit before that, I had stolen a truck from Encinitas Ford. it's kind of a long story. I ended up manipulating this guy, which hopefully if I can, like, kind of rein it in and not be too tangential, I'll get to that because it was pretty cool as part of my, like, ninth step. So I had this stolen truck. Here I am facing like, you know, multiple felonies for theft. I'm like out of my mind. I'm creating a nuisance around me. I'm flooding other people's cells. I ripped the phone out of the socket so that nobody could make phone calls. They moved me down to like, you know, like a segregated population area. They ended up transferring me to a psychiatric unit because they were like, this person is insane and needs help. Here I am in an orange jumpsuit. I have no idea what's going on. I'm in another psychiatric facility. I'm getting strapped down to a bed, medicated against my will, no clue what's going on, and I just thought, I gotta get out of here. Like, I gotta go get high. This is interfering with my thing of being able to do what I want to do. Like, I would malinger and like try to fake cough so that I could get some Robitussin from them, so that I could get high off of Robitussin, and I was trying to get other people to do the same thing. That wasn't working. So I called my friend and said, I need you to be by your phone today. I'm getting out today. And I saw that there was a new admit coming in. I got a pair of size 38 boxers, a cutoff, like, wife beater t-shirt, put that under my jumpsuit, and just waited for the new admit to come in. And I was set that I was leaving the facility that day. And I left the facility that day. I called upon my, like, old basketball days. I did a pick and roll as they opened the door and took off running. And all of a sudden, I became like Harrison Ford from The Fugitive. And I was like, oh, my God, what would he do? What would he do? So I buried the jumpsuit. I covered myself in mud. I hid up in the hills for a little while because I knew that they were going to be looking for a white girl with bleach blonde hair. Mind you, no clue the severity of the consequences that I was going to be facing. That all ended with what I call the jailbird Macarena, which is like arms up behind your back, get on your knees, lay on the ground. You're going back to police custody. And so that is what is public record at this point. And I got back to jail, and I still didn't cooperate. Like, that wasn't enough for me to be in submission, and I was a nuisance there. And I was, like, really, really skinny at the time, probably, like, 20, 30 pounds lighter than I am now. And so I could slip the handcuffs because my wrists would go through them. And I would, like, be getting ready to be transferred to my arraignment, and I would slip the cuffs, and I'd be like, I'm Houdini, bitches. You can't hold me down. Here I am, like, this, like, 5'5", 90-pound white girl from suburbia acting like I'm all thug. And I really thought I was. Like, I wore that jumpsuit like a badge of honor. And I remember my family would come and visit me and just seeing the, like, dismay in them. And I was just so out of touch that I didn't care. Like, it was like this is what my life had come down to. Like, I was just down to be, like, a nobody. And ultimately what happened is I got in a lot of trouble while I was in jail. My public defender met with the district attorney, and they kind of said, hey, this person has done criminal acts, but kind of underneath the surface, this person's really ill. They have a substance use issue, and they're mentally ill. And so I did this plea bargain where I came to San Diego to get help, and I had to stay, like, legit for a year, not get into any more trouble. And then it was determined that they would drop all those charges. And, like, a year and 4 days later, right? That 4 day grace, gotta love it. I didn't stop using. As soon as I got to the psychiatric facility, I was having people sneak me Robitussin, weed, salvia, whatever I could get my hands on. But a year and 4 months later, I vandalized my mom's house. I had this epiphany when I was under the influence of poly substances that basically my mother was the root of all evil. It was her fault that I was the way that I was, and had she done different things to have protected me, that I wouldn't be this crazy demon that I was. So I went and trashed her house and then called the cops on her to have her detained from her house so that I could get my belongings. Like, just talk about the, like, self-centeredness. Like, I think of, like, the part that they talk about in the Big Book on 62-63. My sponsor directs me to those pages all the time. Like, even with the best of intentions, I am just a maker of chaos. So I ended up going to jail that night. She did not. And I remember when I was in there, much like the time before in 2002, thinking, like, I am here because of my substance use. I need to stop. This needs to be different. But I didn't know how to get there. I'd come to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings with my father when I was a child, and I was able to recite, like, how it works. I knew, like, oh, you know, page 417, then 449, like, all this stuff. Like, I had a head full of AA, but I had never, like, tried it myself, so I didn't know exactly what to do or how to do it. But I got to this place where, me left to my own devices, it wasn't working anymore. I managed to get my bachelor's. I stayed up in Santa Barbara for a little bit longer, thinking somehow, some way I might be able to, like, you know, figure things out and have a life up there. And it wasn't working. At the end of that period up there, I would line up 4 or 5 shots of 100 proof vodka. I would line a shot of Robitussin, then I would smoke a bowl, I would eat a little bit of mushrooms, and then I would snort, like, whether, like, it was Adderall, Valium, some sort of, like, upper downer, and then I would do it again and start over in that row until I, like, blacked out, passed out, or something happened, because I did not like how it felt to be me. And I had gotten in touch with my mom in April, of 2005, and I said, I need help. I need to come to San Diego. It's not working for me here. And she said, well, you can come so long as you take your medication and you don't use. And, like, one of the, like, unfortunate things I think about going, like, floridly psychotic and ending up in the system is that all of a sudden, like, your mental health and stability becomes, like, a huge concern of others. And everybody's always wanting to know, like, you know, are you sleeping? Are you taking your meds? How much are you eating? Da-da-da-da, like, all this stuff. And so it's like there was a part where, like, I wanted to have this, like, autonomous freedom and, like, live a life as an adult. But then at the same time, like, the wreckage that I had, like, people just didn't trust me. And my mom didn't want me in her home without being medicated and off of substances. And so I went there, and I had, like, a little bit of period of a time, like, dry, and I had done, like, a couple meetings where I thought, like, okay, maybe I'm ready to do this. And then it just became too much. And I started using. I left her house, and I got this apartment in City Heights. I was living by myself. And it was kind of like, that was the beginning of the end for me. Just to go back, like, real quick, a tiny bit, there was at one point when I was, 20 or 21 that I was deemed gravely disabled due to, psychiatric illness and substance use. So I was issued a conservator. And in that, like, I lost all my rights. It was like, I don't want to take my medication. And it's like, okay, well, then we can go ahead and make an injection version of your medication. And it was, like, really challenging. Like, I felt like there was all this stuff stacked against me. Like, the hole was so deep that I had to dig myself out of that I thought, how am I ever going to have anything that even remotely resembles something close to, like, sanity or stability? And I gave up. And I just went the whole, like, drug addict, alcoholic route. And so in April, I went and I was living by myself. And at that point, I got introduced somehow to muscle relaxants, benzos, and opiates. And I had, like, 80 to 120 pill a day habit. Like, I just used them like a fiend. I would do trips to Mexico and then come back and just use them by myself. Like, and I flipped my car on the 15 freeway. It just so happened that my mom's coworker saw the accident, or her husband saw the accident. And to this day, I don't know how I didn't get a DUI for that. I was high as a kite, but I didn't. And what happened that day, my mom came and visited me in the hospital, and she said, I love you. I'm done. I'm not going to watch you do this anymore. Cause I was sitting begging for more morphine, and I don't really remember being in a whole lot of pain. But I wanted, like, access to morphine. Like, if I'm at the hospital, hook it up mainline, you know? And so she said that she was done. And before that, when I was living in this place by myself, she would come and, like, make sure that I was eating and, like, doing, like, some things to take care of myself. And I remember having the conversation with her of, like, she's like, have you eaten today? And I'm like, no, why would I do that? And she's like, well, to sustain life. And I said to her, I was like, it is so much effort. Like, you have to go to the grocery store and purchase food. Then you have to come home. You have to put it away. After you put it away, if you want to eat it, you have to take it out. Then you have to cook it. If you cook it, then you have to clean it up. And, like, she just, like, looked at me like, oh, my God, like, how did it come to this? And that was when my diet was, like, hot dogs, ketchup, mayonnaise, hot dogs. That was it. And then I told her, I was like, and if I eat, I don't get as high as fast. So for me, that was, like, the rational mentality. So I flipped my car on the 15. That wasn't a wake-up call. I bought a truck off my uncle. I had just a little bit of money left. I ended up getting in 5 more car accidents in that vehicle. And I didn't think, like, oh, I have a problem. It was always like I was able to rationalize. Like, when I was getting on a guardrail and on the freeway, and I hit the guardrail, and I had just given a homeless guy 4 cigarettes, and my thought was, oh, well, if I wasn't giving him my last 4 cigarettes, I wouldn't have hit the guardrail. And, like, all these different things. And so my thought process wasn't, oh, I should get clean and sober. It was, I should stop driving. And somehow, some way, that ended up being an incredible gift, because my world got really, really small. I just stayed in this apartment getting high by myself. I would take a bunch of downers, go to 7-Eleven, get some of the uptime pills, chug a couple monsters, write my lyrics for my, like, you know, LP. nod out, come back to, and like do that. And something happened on October 17th of 2005. I saw myself in the mirror, really sucked up. I don't know if I had like pseudo jaundice or what, but I just looked like shit. And I thought, you know what? If I keep doing this, I'm going to die. And so I called my grandparents and I said, I think I need help. And my grandmother was like, we've been waiting 6 years for this call. And I thought, what the fuck? I haven't even been using 6 years. How could you have been waiting 6 years for this call? And she's all, it just so happens that we're on our way out from Colorado and our motorhome will be there soon. And I thought, oh shit, I don't want that much help. And I got that much help. They were there. I detoxed in their motorhome. God love them. They're very devout Catholics. I am like the antithesis of that. I have respect for religion now, which took me a really long time in sobriety to do. I think whatever works for other people is awesome. If that's organized religion, all the power to you. But it wasn't always that way. So I was like a naked mess, getting sick, having diarrhea. My grandfather was like, can you please put your clothes on? I'm like, can you please stop looking at me, you pervert? And they were like, we need to know how serious you are about rehab. And I'm like, I'm fucking detoxing in your motorhome. Like, how much more serious could I be? So I gave them $5,000 for them to kind of pay the rest of the way for rehab because I was, like, super serious about it. And they wanted to send me to some program that was, like, really expensive for 30 days. And I think somehow underneath, I knew, like, I shouldn't spend that kind of money on 30 days. I should find a program that I could get longer than that because I knew that I needed more help. And so I ended up trading 180 Valium with my grandmother for two cartons of Parliament Light cigarettes and a ride to rehab. And when I got to rehab, I thought that I was going to start out on, like, the 30-day trek. I thought everybody started out on the 30-day, and then if it was determined you needed more, there was that kind of flex option. Well, after I met with the director, she's like, okay, so you'll be on the 90-day track. And I was like, what? Like, I flipped out. And I talked to my uncle at that time. He's got like 25 years. A lot of my family is in the program. And then there's a lot of them that need to be in the program and they're not. And he said, 90 days is such a small time of your life. If you take 90 days and compare it to how long you've already been alive, he's like, it's small. Give yourself a chance. And I gave myself a chance. I believe that my higher power somehow, some way landed me in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in these rooms, I found a power greater than myself that I could do business with. And to this day, that's been the best thing that I said okay to in the like 33 years that I've been alive. And I was a nuisance in rehab. I mean, talk about like the drinking is but a symptom of the greater problem, which is that that 552 kind of in the beginning part of that story is where it talks about that the substance is but a symptom. Like I am the symptom. Even to this day, like my best thoughts would probably land me in a federal penitentiary for the rest of my life. But a power greater than me has given me this thing called like restraint. I didn't have a lot of restraint in my first year. I think it's like fair to say that I probably did worse things in my first year sober than I did when I was out there using. And I think it's even more shameful because at least when we're out there using, we could say like, hey, I got high. That's why. But I had to shed a lot of darkness in order to get to the other side. And there were a handful of people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that reached out to me when most ran away from me. And they gave me a chance. They gave me an opportunity. And when I was in rehab, I did so much stuff. Like, they told me at the end, they were like, you lost more privileges for this facility in the 6 months you were here than everybody before you had lost. Like, you were a nuisance. And for, like, what I did is it was like, I didn't know what to do with free time. I didn't know how to, like, manage all this stuff that was here. So naturally, I created chaos and wreaked havoc on the lives of others because that's what I knew how to do. And then about 70 days in, I realized like, oh my God, I haven't taken this seriously. I need to do something in order to like really give myself a chance. And I got serious at that point. Up to that point, I was setting stuff on fire at rehab. I was burning people's things. I was hiding people's flipper tooth retainers so that they had to like walk around missing their teeth. I was smearing cat shit under people's beds. Just like, it was just trash-tastic what I was doing. And I remember there was this guy at rehab. He was one of the night staff. And he looked at me after, there was this woman who I resented, and it was her duty to clean the kitchen, and it was my duty to clear the buffet area in rehab. So I cleared the buffet area, and when I went, I spilled stuff every step of the way so that she would have to clean it up. And he looked at me, and he said, "I expected more of you than this by now." And it really grabbed me. Because I thought, holy shit, for the first time somebody expects something good of me, and I'm like letting this person down. And so I thought, okay, I need to radically change my life and what I'm doing. So I got ready and I got serious and I started doing these steps. I got a sponsor and I went through all 12 of them. And for the first step, admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I love that that was a we thing because I'd felt alone for so long. And for me, there was no doubt in my mind that I was powerless over insert alcohol, any other substance. I tried everything. I even like consumed toothpaste in mass quantities because I thought it might change the way I felt. I saw that my life was unmanageable. I mean, I kind of testified to some of the unmanageable, so that wasn't a problem for me. So for that step, I wrote a list of all the ways that I was powerless, all the ways that my life had become unmanageable. And then I went on to the second step, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I knew that I was insane. And so that lent me to be open to the perspective that something greater than me might be able to restore me to sanity. But I feared God. Like when I came into these rooms, anytime somebody said like, "Oh, I'm so grateful," or "I just love my higher power, God is great," like I would say all these blasphemous things to undo the like spiritual connection that they had because I resented it and loathed it. And so my sponsor said, just make a list of, you know, my God is, my God is not, I want my God to be. So that's what I did for my second step, you know, along with reading in the book in the 12 and 12. And for me, it was like, I wanted my God to be like always there, and I wanted to feel God. And that was like the first time that I conceded to like anybody or anything that I wanted to have a connection with something greater than me. And my sponsor said, "You'll have it and see it and feel it as soon as you're open to it." And I thought, okay, well, that seems easy enough. And there's the whole idea that all you have to do is be willing to be willing to believe. And I thought, okay, I can do that. I don't know that I can fully believe, but I'll be willing to be willing to believe. And I read, it's AA-approved literature, what is it, Came to Believe? And I read these stories about how all these people came to like find higher powers. And I thought, wow, that's it. Like, this isn't like burning bush. Like, I could get down with that. And so I started to have God in my life, and God has transformed for me from day number one to what it is now. It's just radically different. I can't entirely describe it, but it's this sense that no matter what, even when no matter what happens, I'll be okay. I'm going to get through it, and I don't have to pick up a drink. So to go from somebody that feared and hated God to somebody that has faith that no matter what, it's going to work out, to me, is a miracle. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood. And that's a daily thing. I like being behind the wheel. I like, you know, going like full throttle. But I also see now when I go full throttle, it cuts me off from the sunlight of the universe, and it no longer enables me to be of service to my fellows. So today I have this feeling within that starts to kick off when I realize that I'm no longer in like God's will. And what it is if I'm having to try too hard and I have to keep going and going and going, whatever it is, usually that's an indication that it's not God's will. If it's God's will, that shit opens up and it's just easy. It's like, okay, I walk here and this is where I'm supposed to go. So like I started out with, the like kind of 60 to 63, that's the pages of the big book that my sponsor directs me to all the time. Like I should have that memorized. I should be able to do like a Shakespearean monologue of that section of the big book because I see it all the time. And it's true that like even with the best of intentions, like I'm the maker of chaos. I have no idea how amazing things are in store for me when I'm behind that wheel too fast, too hard. Step four, so for that step, when I was new, I wrote a letter of resignation as ruler of the universe and gave that position to God. And it was essentially like, It was pretty cool. It was essentially like my own version of the third step prayer. And then four made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. My first four step was really long. I had a lot of resentments. I had a lot of like classless, shady sex inventory stuff. Most of all, I resented myself is what it came down to. And so it was this work of like dancing a line between living a different life and not drifting off into like morbid reflection and self-pity, because that too diminishes my usefulness to others. And I remember in 2002 when I was trying to do the like steps haphazardly, I just wasn't getting the my part column. It was like beyond me how I could have a part in all these wrongs that other people had done to me. And it's so fascinating that when, even to this day, when I can see my part in a resentment or like in some conflict that I have with other people, it's so liberating, because that I can change. I can't change other people, but I can change the way that I dance with others. I shared it with my sponsor. She didn't seem overly impressed with all of my stuff. She just kind of said, okay, well, here's your list for your eight step. Like, let's get going. Entirely ready to have God remove all these defects in character, and humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. I was supposed to make a list of all my defects in character and pray on them for the like transition of like fifth step through eighth. And I remember I went back to rehab and I was like, I don't know what my defects in character are. And this guy, Mark, who had said that we expected more, he just looked at me like, I'm like, seriously, I don't know. Do I have defects in character? And he was like, well, why don't you start with like self-centered, selfish, inconsiderate, rude? And I was like, holy shit, okay, I see I have defects. Like, that's enough. And then it got time to like, I had the list of people. My initial list was 66 people, places, institutions, and things. And it had since grown as I had like more moments of clarity with the more time that I had sober. But my ninth step, I don't know if it's like because I'm a masochist or a sadist or what exactly it is, but I really liked facing people that I had wronged. Like, it was kind of cool. Like, hey, I might like get shit on. These people might tell me to go like fuck myself. Like, this would be kind of cool. And I've had some incredible experiences making amends. Like, it's so cool, the family amends that I got to make. My mom, like, welcomes me into her home today. The Encinitas Ford thing, go back to that full circle. So I went and made amends to this guy who worked at Encinitas Ford. He had an AA necklace on when I went in there and stole the truck. I wrote a fraudulent check, and I manipulated him. I was like, oh, hey, you're a friend of Bill's, da-da-da-da-da, all this stuff. And... and so I went in there and made amends to this guy, and I was like, you know, is there anything else I can do to right the wrong? And he's like, you know, you really made, like, my boss's life a nightmare more so than you did mine. Maybe you could go make amends to him. So I did that, and it just so happens that, like, 2 years ago when I was speaking at a young people's meeting, this kid came up to me afterwards and was like, I was working at Encinitas Ford that day when you came and did that. And he's like, and I thought, holy shit, people in AA do that kind of stuff? And, he had later come into the rooms and was one of us. And it's just like, I've had so many God shots like that throughout. The 10th step, continued to take personal inventory. And when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. In my first 3 years, I used to think that that was a loophole to continue to be an asshole and be mean to other people. And it was like, oh, I could do this. I just have to promptly, you know, admit my wrong, do things differently. But now, I have a conscience and I don't like hurting other people. You know, I don't want to be that person that I was. I didn't get sober to continue to do the same shameful, despicable, demoralizing things. And it was about maybe one and a half or 2 years sober, I started to see the ramifications that my words and actions had on other people. And I didn't want to do that anymore. I no longer took pride in having that razor sharp tongue. And I was able to shed like all these years of like self-loathing and other loathing and become more open to humanity, because I love people. Like, that's the reality of it. I have a lot of care and concern for people other than myself, and this program has enabled me to kind of get in touch with that part of me. The 11th step, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand God. Praying only for the knowledge of God's will and the power to carry that out. That's an ongoing thing. I'm not perfect. I don't have a daily meditation set up. Maybe I should. I know a lot of people do. For me, I get too in the head and I'm like, this is some regimented thing. I don't necessarily believe that I should be on my knees doing this exactly like this. I'm going to like go through the motions and pray to this higher power in this way. And it's like, it's a fucking nightmare. But for me, when I drive to work and I see the sun rising as I'm going east on the 94, it's like, that's God, that's beauty, that's magic. I'm not alone. This thing wants me to do better than I think and to be of service to my fellows. And that's the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, you know, to carry this message to other people and to practice these principles in all my affairs. And I'll close with this. I remember interacting with people thinking like, how egregious do you let them be where you just say, fuck it, you're an asshole, I'm not practicing principles. And my sponsor said to me, you're the personality that they're talking about. You put principles before your personality. And so today, that is what I strive to do. And by the grace of God, I have 10 years sober. I've been afforded the opportunity to go back to school, and I get to help other people. I work with people right now predominantly who have schizophrenia, and I believe in even the most hopeless of cases. I was a hopeless case. Like, people didn't think that I would be okay. And a period of sobriety, a period of doing the things that I need to do, like, I've been able to get to that other side. And my goal right now is to start to save money to open up a home where people with severe mental illness can live. And the idea is for them to be habilitated, not rehabilitated, because I don't think a lot of those people in our culture are given the opportunity to be habilitated in the first place. So there is no rehabilitation. As a way to help them truly integrate into the community and avoid hospitalization. So I think that God has restored my life. I don't know why I get to be one of the few of us that stays sober, but I know that it's a gift that I don't ever want to take for granted, and I want to continue to do God's work and to help other people. Thank you for letting me.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.